Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
You are standing in the halls of Sichel Castle. You approach a golden chalice, resplendent in an embossed spiral of geologic time that winds round from rim to base. At the merest touch, the chalice chimes and shivers, dragging you back through 200 years of history, to the castle's raising in the Transylvanian wilds of Hattig. You grasp the golden chalice, and time sheds from your perspective like the skin of a great serpent, spiraling out in every direction as you descend through the depths of centuries, millennia, through eons of evolutionary change and geologic upheaval, till the chalice slips from your trembling grip and leaves you in an age of wonders.
Hattig as you knew it is gone, now a paleo island rising up out of the late Cretaceous Sea. You glimpse movement and note the approach of several sauropods, only these are not the hulking giants you're familiar with. They seem dwarf creatures, the size of ponies. You could ride one if only you dared to approach its alien flesh. But before you can muster the courage, the creatures scatter from the clearing. Predatory theropods, too, flee back into the forests as a great shadow descends from the sky, a pterosaur to rival the dragon Bowler of myth. It lands before you, it towers like a siege engine, but you've already thrown yourself to the ground. You're fumbling for the golden chalice so that it might take you home or take you further back, anywhere to escape the jaws of Hatzegopteryx then Bema.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And as you can probably guess from that fun little cold open that we prepared for you there, we are going to be traveling back in time in this episode via paleontology. Back to prehistoric Transylvania.
That is so exciting. Robert, I can tell you are just itching to, like, write a novel about this this ancient paleo island.
Yeah, I was really inspired by this. This is one of those situations where I was inspired by reading a dinosaur book to my son.
Uh-huh.
There's a book titled Atlas of Dinosaur Adventures by Emily Hawkins and illustrated by Lucy Leatherland. And it has these wonderful, big two-page spreads that show a different part of the world and an idea of what prehistoric life might have looked like. Mm-hmm. And they had a spread, they cover every continent, and they had a spread for Haydig, showing like what prehistoric Transylvania, what prehistoric Romania would have might have consisted of.
Uh-huh.
And I have to admit, despite having covered sauropods on the show, and certainly we've talked about gigantic pterosaurs quite recently, I wasn't really familiar with this corner of the prehistoric world.
It set off a little explosion in your mind. I can sense the energy coming off of you on the subject of Haydig. And I wanted to say that your opening reminded me of two different things. The poem Directive by Robert Frost, which is about going back in time, and it also involves a chalice.
Oh, does it?
Yeah. It talks about like, I wonder it's like if I read Grail
it and forgot
kind of
about it, or if I just came up with that idea, via some connection to things that were inspired by what he wrote?
You should look it up again. It's a great poem, Directive.
It
was like a cross between Directive and A Sound of Thunder.
Yes. Yeah. And I also was definitely thinking about The Time Machine.
Uh-huh.
Who can escape Wells's Time Machine when considering the past at all? I mean, anytime you're thinking about dinosaurs, you can, and other prehistoric creatures such as the pterosaurs, you can't help but imagine like traveling back and encountering them. That's the ultimate frame of reference, right? What if I was standing next to one?
But this is the ultimate real monster versus fictional monster crossover because not to call dinosaurs monsters, but they're one of the closest things to monster myths, dragon myths that you've got in the real world. So you've got like a really interesting sort of dinosaur fossil site with interesting biogeographical qualities that we will explore as we go on in the rest of the episode. But it's right there in Transylvania, right? It's vampire country.
Indeed. And, we will encounter a fossil that has been dubbed Dracula.
Oh, boy.
By the paleontologist covering it.
How about those pony-sized sauropods? You didn't make that up, did you?
No. That's one of like the really amazing things about this particular scenario, and ultimately about everything we're going to talk about in this episode is that we're looking at an example, a prehistoric example of island dwarfism and island gigantism, also known as the island factor or the island rule. And this is a concept we've talked about on the show before.
Oh, yeah. It's come up several times. It has to do with body size in populations of animals that become isolated. Because it doesn't have to be on islands. Islands is just the easiest way for it to happen. Like another way it can happen are in these interesting ecosystems known as sky islands where I don't know if you've ever—
Would this be like essentially a plateau?
It could be like that. One great example that I've been to is like in Big Bend National Park in Texas. So you have desert, and then in the middle of this, there are some mountains rising up. And as you go up the slopes of the mountains and in between them, at the higher altitudes, actually, the climate changes, right? Because at higher altitudes, it almost kind of mimics higher latitudes. Mm. And so the types of plants you find change, the types of animals you find change. It goes from sort of desert to a weird kind of forest up in the higher parts of the mountains. And so this can function kind of like an island, right? Because there are creatures that can survive up in those mountain forests but can't traverse the vast expanses of desert down below. Or if they do, it can be very dangerous and they're might not make it to anywhere they could survive. So anyway, wherever you have a case where species can survive in a very limited geographical range and they're cut off from the rest of the continental populations, you can have these cases of island gigantism or island dwarfism. Basically, smaller species tend to become larger and larger species tend to become smaller. And there are multiple reasons for this, but mainly it's that the smaller species tend to become larger because on islands there is a lack of predators that they would encounter on the mainland that would be a check on their growth. Meanwhile, larger species tend to become smaller, presumably because of a lack of energy resources that you would find on the mainland. There's less to eat on the island, so it actually pays to have a smaller body that requires less food. A commonly cited example of this is like the mammoths that were found on certain islands, like the gigantic Colombian mammoth evolved a dwarf variety on the Channel Islands off the coast of California. There mm-hmm. was also the Wrangell Island mammoths that were, I think, the last woolly mammoths on Earth that went extinct around 4,000 years ago were smaller than their continental varieties.
And the basic idea with these examples is that they were able to reach these islands mm-hmm. When the water level was lower, mm-hmm. and then they end up trapped there, essentially, and life goes on and evolution continues.
Right. Life goes on, but there's less to eat. So mm-hmm. if you're trying to make a bigger body, you're more likely to starve to death. So the ones with genes for smaller bodies tend to be the ones that survive. And so obviously we think about, you know, examples of this in the recent past or in the modern world, but the same principles of evolution and energy and food dynamics would have been in place in the time of dinosaurs, right?
Exactly.
So you could run into exactly the same issue, and it seems like that's exactly what's going on in this ancient Transylvanian island called Hadag.
Yes, 66 million years ago, this region was an island in the large body of water that we refer to now as the Tethys Sea. And this would have covered large parts of Europe up through the late Cretaceous period, and it would have caused resulting group of islands to essentially be a European archipelago. And German-born paleontologist Hans-Dieter Suess describes it as a, quote, shallow epicontinental sea dotted with variously sized islands.
Hmm.
Suess is senior scientist and curator of vertebrate paleontology at the National Museum of Natural History of the Smithsonian Institution, and he even has a dinosaur named after him. So, you know, he's the real deal.
It's a pachycephalosaur, right?
Mm-hmm. Pachycephalosaur Hansususia.
Hansususia.
Always a good sign in a paleontologist.
The amount of honor is directly proportional to how hard it is to say. It's a little known fact.
We should also note that, you know, we're talking a long time ago here, so it's not merely an issue, oh, Europe was flooded back then.
Right.
Suess points out in a 2010 paper titled An Unusual Dinosaur from the Late Cretaceous of Romania and the Island Rule, there was complex tectonic activity along the northern margin of the western Tethys, and then there was volcanic activity that resulted in these Cretaceous islands rising up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the largest of these covered much of what we now know as the Iberian Peninsula and France, extending into central Europe. Now, this particular island in the Tethys Sea, which corresponds to the modern region of Hadag, Transylvania, this would have been roughly, I'm reading, 80,000 square kilometers or 30,888 square miles. And to put that in perspective, modern-day Ireland is roughly 32,595 square miles in size.
So sort of Ireland size.
Yeah, sort of a Romanian Ireland that's crawling with odd-sized prehistoric creatures. So that's how we came to have these islands, roughly, these European islands in the late Cretaceous. We ended up with various creatures stranded upon these islands. And they were subject to evolutionary changes that we refer to roughly as the island rule.
Mm-hmm.
So the Titanic sauropod is humbled to the size of a pony, and other creatures that we'll get to, you know, rise to much larger sizes. And who would read such a thing from the fossil record? You know, you might think, especially given that paper I just cited from 2010, you might think, well, this is a fairly recent discovery.
Right.
You especially might think that if you like me, were not familiar with this marvelous world of oversized and undersized prehistoric beasts. But to look to the origin of these discoveries, we have to look to a rogue Austro-Hungarian baron of the late 19th and early 20th century.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will meet the baron.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So it's time to meet the Baron, a character who plays a major role in the history of the science and discovery of the paleo island Hadig. And this Baron is Baron Franz Nopcha von Felsow-Zilvas, who lived 1877 to 1933.
Yes, Baron Nopcha. And I have to admit, when we started this episode, I really didn't expect there to be a fascinating human story in the midst of all of this, even though, of course, paleontology is always a human story because paleontologists are the humans who uncover these secrets of the past. But I thought this was just going to be all, rampaging prehistoric beasts.
Right.
But this is a fascinating individual. And Smithsonian.com has a great article on Nopcha titled, History Forgot This Rogue Aristocrat Who Discovered Dinosaurs and Died Penniless by Vanessa Veselka, which goes into far more detail on his life than we're going to explore here, you know, especially concerning some tragic later portions of his life.
He was a really interesting figure, though. And this is a great article, by the way. This is one that I think listeners just should go off and read, definitely.
Yeah, he is, you know, it's tempting to want to just sum him up in a few words, like say, oh, he was, you know, a gentleman scientist towards the end of the time period in which that gentleman scientist was a thing. And that's, I think, mostly true. But then there are all these other weird dimensions to his character. So he was born into privilege and aristocracy, but he also seemed to live with what we would now likely classify as a manic depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. You know, he was apparently prone to periods of intense focus and energy, which it is good when you're engaging in early fossil study and some of the other activities he was involved in. But then, of course, the flip side is that there were these morose periods as well.
Uh-huh. He's also described as being absolutely brilliant in a scientific sense and mostly self-taught, mm-hmm. Just learning from writing to people and getting them to send him books and then teaching yes. himself subjects biology and geology that, he didn't have formal training in, and then making all of these discoveries about dinosaurs and paleontology and about deep time, but also not always having the right kind of social skills
yeah.
within the professional context to get his work accepted. Apparently he was very rude and could be very rude, but could also be very charming.
Yeah. Yeah. And so much of it again was he was self-taught. He's mm-hmm. he's writing other experts and getting them to send him books. Or there's also the story of him going off to university and bringing this fossil with him mm-hmm. from the area of Romania in he was from, and the professor there was what is this? Help me figure this out. And he's like, I don't know. You go figure it out.
Yeah.
Essentially, send him back with it, which. Which as the author points out of that Smithsonian piece, Veselka says that's either some great tutelage where the professor mm-hmm. is like, oh, I'm going to grow this young mind by inspiring them to go find the answer themselves. Or it's a really lazy or overworked professor who's I don't have time to help you, decipher this rock. Go do it yourself.
Right.
But do it himself, he did.
Yeah.
And so he's one of these remarkable, accounts of he's kind of a self-made gentleman scientist, though obviously had a certain advantage on the situation by being born into the aristocracy.
Well, yeah, that's a common thing you see in the history of science, that a lot of the great scientists of the 19th century, say, were sort of aristocrat types. Obviously, I don't think that's because aristocrats are better at science. It's because they had the resources and the leisure to mm-hmm. pursue to get into these pursuits. If you are a farmer working night and day, you don't have the time and the money to go into the sciences.
Yeah, yeah. So he was, and then he's kind of emerging towards the end of the gentleman science being a thing at all. Mm-hmm. And certainly towards the end of his career and the end of his life, he was kind of shut out from scientific circles.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the ideas that he was promoting during his life were ultimately ideas that were not widely accepted, though interestingly enough, would become widely accepted many decades later. In the 1970s, for example, is a time when people started looking back at him and saying, oh, here's this interesting character from the history books. He published 150 scientific papers in his life, and he identified 25 genera of reptiles and 5 different dinosaurs, mm-hmm. but we've largely forgotten him, and we don't celebrate him at all. And people started, looking back and realizing who he was and what he had discovered here. And there are other aspects to his life that are all interesting as well. He was an adventurous individual. He served as a spy for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but he seems to have largely used his service to the state as a vehicle for pursuing his interest in geography and geology and the study of the Albanian people.
Right. There seems to be this mix of interests here because he apparently just loved the Albanian culture and wanted to study it and, document all their customs and everything like that. But the government that was funding his work basically wanted a sort of the early 20th century equivalent of a CIA fact book on a country.
Right. Yeah.
They wanted intelligence that could be used in warfare or something like that later on. So that's the money going into what he's doing. But he apparently was just in love with Albania and its people and its culture.
And at one point, even threw his name in the hat to potentially be a king.
Oh, yeah.
There's that whole storyline. Again, I encourage everyone to read that article about him. But again, in his scientific pursuits, he was very much ahead of his time. For starters, The theory of continental drift is now widely, if not universally, accepted. But this was not the case during Noakes's life. Yet he presented some of the most credible geologic evidence at the time for continental drift. And then, of course, when it came to fossils, this is where he made his arguably his greatest impact. Mm-hmm. He discovered some very curious fossils in the Hantik region, many of which were noticeable for being quite smaller than examples that were popping up elsewhere. And he argued that these were examples of the island rule in action, that the Hantik region was once an island in a prehistoric sea. Now, we'll get to the specific dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures in a little bit, but just consider. He found titanosaur sauropods the size of mere ponies, despite the fact that titanosaurs are the largest land animals that we know to have ever existed, reaching sizes of, you know, we're talking 121 feet or 37 meters long and weights of somewhere in the neighborhood of 76 tons. And yet he finds fossil evidence of these multiple noticeably smaller sauropods. And it just raised the question, well, what were they?
So, well, I mean, the obvious thing is that they're juveniles, dummy, right? aren't they just baby sauropods?
Yeah, that was what critics argued, that these were just juveniles. And certainly one of the more alarming things about sauropods is that they do grow to such alarming size from relatively small eggs. Mm-hmm. I mean, sauropods are weird and strange creatures, that we're still, figuring out, all the, the answers to the mysteries of their biology. And so, just the fact that you find some small ones, it does seem like it could be one possible explanation could be that, well, these were just the juveniles. And this read doesn't seem to have completely fallen out of fashion. As recently as 2007, a paper in Historical Biology by Jean Leloup argued that that some Hantik sauropod fossils might suggest, quote, age class communities among sauropod populations.
Oh, so this is like a gang of sauropod youths.
Yes, exactly. Like a street gang of youths. I believe we've discussed this sort of thing in terms of crocodilians and maybe Komodo dragons on the show in the past. Mm-hmm. The idea that some animals experience tremendous body size changes and therefore corresponding changes in diet and behavior and may be thought of as living in their own niche during different phases of their life, either alone or in groups.
Yeah, different life phases, they're almost kind of like different animals.
Yeah, so, like a small Komodo dragon is going to eat different food than a full-grown adult Komodo dragon. And the same might be the case with like a juvenile sauropod versus, of course, a fully grown towering sauropod.
Hmm.
But according to Seuss, subsequent bone studies have backed up the theory that we're seeing the effects of the island rule in the bones of these fun-sized sauropods. Basically, in 2010, a team of paleontologists looked at the microstructure of the bones to determine age and growth patterns, and they showed that this particular sauropod, these pony sauropods, were fully grown adults with small body sizes. And this is from a paper from Benton et al., published in Paleoclimatology, Paleoecology.
Right. I think so. It mentioned in one of the articles we were reading, I think it was that Smithsonian article, that his methodology was that he actually did molecular analysis of the bones, like that Noakes was able to determine that the dinosaurs were small adults and not young because he was able to like look at the layers of bone like osteogenesis rings.
Right.
Within cross sections of these bones.
Yeah. So,
or the fossils, I mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was not just, making a wild guess here. He was forming the best scientific hypothesis that he could based on the material. And I have to say, though, I guess it's just the idea of pony-sized sauropods mm-hmm. is just so attractive.
So Flintstones.
It is. And there was some movie growing up, too. I think it may have just been called The Last Dinosaur or like, maybe the dinosaur had a name, but I remember there being like a pony-sized sauropod, some sort of puppet that the actors interact with. I remember seeing that as a child. So this probably, brings back some of those memories. But then also I mentioned when I was telling my son about this reading to him from that dinosaur book I mentioned earlier, you know, he was instantly in love with this idea of pony-sized sauropods. Uh-huh. Because I guess the idea is if it is pony-sized, you could ride it. You could walk up to the gentle sauropod and jump on its back and go for a wild ride through the late Cretaceous jungle.
That's so good. I don't know if this is the same last dinosaur you were thinking of. I was trying to call something out of the deep childhood memory, and it is a dinosaur from an animated series. I think it was like French or something called Denver, the Last Dinosaur. And it is he's like a hip skateboarding sunglasses wearing dinosaur with a kind of with a head feature that looks like a mohawk. And I can't tell if he's supposed to be a sauropod or a theropod. It seems unclear.
No, I don't think I've seen that one. This would have been a live action affair that I'm thinking of.
Okay.
Like a VHS rental for sure.
Well, maybe after we get out of the studio today, we can go watch some Denver, The Last Dinosaur and see how it does.
All right. Well, we're going to take another break. But when we come back, we'll discuss some of the specific prehistoric creatures that we have thus far encountered in Hottig.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you ride the books, Gene. Last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back, and it's time to discuss the pony size Magyarosaurus.
Okay, let's go for a ride. Just saddle them up.
All right. So again, while some have considered them to be juveniles, perhaps living in their own, you know, social group apart from the giant adults, bone evidence seems to suggest that they were fully grown adults. And this would be, you know, probably be perhaps one of nature's most impressive displays of the island effect, humbling even the mighty Titanosaur into a form, you know, more befitting of this late Cretaceous Ireland-sized island in what is now known as Romania. So sauropods in general, again, are just strange and mysterious creatures, perhaps some of the strangest creatures ever to walk the earth. I mean, they push the boundaries of what's possible in a terrestrial organism, like what's sustainable, what's even, you know, morphologically possible. And, you know, and if these little guys are just a ripple in an already amazing glimpse of the prehistoric past, I mean, we've been seeing sauropods our entire lives, right? I mean, we see them in cartoons, in toys, and you kind of take them for granted, right? They're just this thing that Fred Flintstone slides down the neck of, or the tail of, I can't remember, at the end of his workday. But
getting petted by Sam Neill.
Yeah, they're just kind of in Jurassic Park, they're just kind of the backdrop. They don't really do anything.
Right. Well, because they're not a meaty Dasaurus.
But they are their own mystery, you know, when you start getting into the details of, you know, how they fed themselves and and even various discussions about, you know, just how something this big lives.
Yeah, I mean, it starts, well, as you were just alluding to, it sort of makes you question the what are the extremes of what an animal can be and how it can survive. Like, you know, obviously we've talked about giant animals on the show before and about how they're just sort of like problems that you might not even expect when animals start getting past a certain size and volume, problems with like heat distribution or like heat exchange. And of course there'd be like energy issues, especially. So sauropods are, you know, these are going to be herbivores, right? Mm-hmm. They're not meatosaurus. So they're needing to eat plant matter in order to sustain a body the size of a boat or bigger, you know? So like, you just start to wonder, like, how could they possibly eat enough to survive? How could they do it?
Yeah, it feels like biology is just out of control to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I guess you could look at it like that. You know, like, here is a form that is totally unsustainable if anything drastic happens to the environment. Mm-hmm. And, of course, drastic things did happen to the environment.
Right.
These were not the forms to survive the late Cretaceous extinction event. But, yeah, I would love to come back and do perhaps a whole episode on sauropods in the future, or bring on, a guest, an expert who can talk to us about the weird mysteries of sauropod life.
Totally. Now, right at the beginning of the episode, we mentioned a pterosaur called Hatzegopteryx. I know this one caught your fancy, Robert. So what's the deal with Hatzegopteryx?
All right. So we've talked about the flying pterosaurs on the show before, the prehistoric flying reptiles that took to the air on a membrane of flesh that stretched between their ankles and their greatly elongated fourth finger.
So creepy to see the skeletons and realize that the wing is a finger.
Yeah, because it's a distinctly different wing arrangement compared to the vertebrate flight of birds and bats.
Mm-hmm. Closer to bats, it seems like.
Closer to bats, yeah. But still, you know, very much its own thing. And of course, we've recently discussed the mighty Quetzalcoatlus. This godlike giant pterosaur that was found in the late Cretaceous, but in North America. And we often speak of it as being perhaps the largest creature to ever fly, if indeed it truly did fly. And most paleontologists seem to think that it did, but there is some disagreement there. We'll get into an example of that.
Uh-huh.
But, it's ultimately only one of the sky lords of old. Because we certainly had Q, the winged serpent, but we also had Hatzegopteryx. Both are of the same family as Darkidae, so named for the Persian dragon Azdaha. So Hatzegopteryx was a pterosaur, a winged reptile that, when it was standing on the ground, would have been as tall as a giraffe.
Yeah.
And that's on, we're not talking like reared up on its hind legs exactly, though its morphology is very distinct. We have an image of this creature, an artistic rendering that you'll find on our homepage at stufftoblowyourmind.com. But as it's standing there on its hind legs and on its wings, it would have been as tall as a giraffe with this enormous head. And if it were to actually spread its wings, it would have a wingspan of roughly 36 feet. It had this broad skull, and you look at examples of the skull, or at least ideas of what the full skull would have looked like, and it almost looks too big to fly, but apparently it was made flyable by a polystyrene-like structure that gave it tremendous strength but also lightness.
Yeah, this is a thing you see with birds and you see with pterosaurs, because their bones have to be very light in order to fly, so they often have a kind of hollow or low density structure.
Now, one of the really cool and ultimately nightmarish things about the Hatzegopteryx and its large pterosaur kin is that regardless of their flying ability, to whatever extent they were or were not capable of flying, their fossils suggested they were rather adept at moving about on all fours on the ground. And not only just moving about, but hunting their prey in this fashion. So, great folded living cargo planes that tower over the dwarf herds of sauropods, scooping them up in their powerful jaws and gobbling them down. That's ultimately the vision that we're left with. It's astounding to imagine this thing, this form that has evolved to take to the air and then returned a giant to the earth and then ruling over these diminished sauropods.
Yeah, it's not really similar to what you see with birds, for example, because birds don't crawl with their wings.
Right.
When birds move around on the ground, they walk on 2 feet. They're more like the theropod. Dinosaur design. They walk on the 2 feet and they got their wings folded up. These are more like, sometimes you can see bats crawl this way, where they've got the winged hands that are part of the wings, but they still use them to crawl quadrupedally. And so when you see representations of this, I've seen it animated, the way mm-hmm. these giant pterosaurs would crawl, it looks messed up. It's really scary.
Yeah, I think bats are probably the best contemporary comparison. Particularly, there is a type of bat that you'll find in New Zealand, the Mysticinidae bats, and they spend much of their time on the ground. They're certainly capable of flight, but they crawl around a lot of the time. So they have their claws have extra projections that aid in digging around in the dirt and climbing on the sides of trees, mm-hmm. and their wings fold back in a unique way. So they're it's more streamlined. So when it's in ground mode, it really looks more like some manner of rodent in a sense. I mean, it's still clearly a bat, but it does seem like you're seeing a similar situation where this winged form has taken back to the earth, and due to the particular relaxation of the predatory pressure in its environment is able to sort of become a big deal on the ground again.
Oh, okay. So Hatzegopteryx, big on the ground.
Big on the ground, a big deal on the ground. I guess that's one of the things that's just so topsy turvy about the scenario, right? Is that again the small sauropods and the giant winged creature that doesn't necessarily have to fly anymore, mm-hmm. that they can just roam about on all fours and gobble up whatever it pleases,
uh-huh.
with virtually no predators, and that's key too to figuring out why Hatzegopteryx was so big. It would have had no predators and an abundance of food. And here's the thing, perhaps even a larger food than they would have found elsewhere, because they have this enormous meal. They're probably not eating a sauropod in other scenarios, but here.
Well, no, of course not. I mean, unless they're maybe scavenging or something.
Right, yeah. But here, suddenly the sauropods are smaller, perhaps even bite size or fun size, if uh-huh. you will. And so they grew large and dominant, lords of earth and sky, in keeping with the mahars of Edgar Rice Burroughs' fiction. These were the sort of pterosaur-like creatures that ruled over one of his fictional worlds.
Fattened on sauroponies.
Yes. There is even one particularly large fossil that they found in Hattig that they actually dubbed Dracula. And this was in 2009. And they found fragments of an even larger specimen, or at least a specimen with a far larger lower jaw, in 2018. Michael Habib, an expert on pterosaurs at the University of Southern California, told NationalGeographic.com in 2018 that he believed that this latest specimen especially was probably too large to fly. That it may have flown when it was younger, but then it basically reaches the point where it's large enough and it doesn't have to anymore. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because we're kind of coming back to this idea of a creature growing and its sort of mode of operations, its diet changing. So you could have a creature here that, you know, when it's young, it's still flying from place to place. But then once it reaches a significant size, it has no need to fly anymore, maybe has limited ability to even achieve powered flight anymore. Mm-hmm. But it's not an issue because it's a towering pterosaur monster that eats all the dwarf sauropod babies that it wants. And then Michael Habib, he compares this to the elephant birds of Madagascar, which went extinct roughly 1,000 years ago, but were a large flightless bird that thrived in that part of the world, cut off from the rest of Africa.
Big death ostrich.
Yeah. But there are a few other examples worth touching on here. For instance, there's Tomatosaurus. This was a hadrosaur or a duck-billed dino. Another variety I'd love to come back to and discuss in detail on the show because they're so alien and also in some ways a great example of kind of peak dinosaur prior to the late Cretaceous extinction event. Mm-hmm. But this particular specimen in Hattig was smaller than a modern crocodile, so roughly like 5 meters long or so. And this was one that would have seemed almost mountable to a human if you were standing next to it, mm-hmm. or at least while this hadrosaur was on all fours. Because other hadrosaurs were considerably larger and would have towered over humans, particularly when they reared up on their into bipedal form.
Uh-huh.
And here's another interesting fact about Tomatosaurus. A fossil of a juvenile specimen was discovered in 2016 with evidence of a benign tumor in its lower jaw.
Hmm.
And this is a first for a dinosaur fossil and ultimately proof that such tumors are not mere modern biological realities.
Oh, of course.
And then there's Baldar Bondoc.
Okay.
And this is, we referenced this name earlier in the cold open, but this particular species was named after the dragon of Romanian legend. And so this would have been a theropod hunter in keeping with raptors such as Velociraptor. And it's one of the dromaeosaurids, but it differs from other dromaeosaurid fossils because it had only two functional digits on its hand. Most of its relatives would have had three for proper grasping, so reduced ability in this department. But it also had more digit functionality in its large talon feet.
Mm.
And so this is what Seuss has to say about this. Thus, each foot of Baldar sported a double set of these large claws, which were likely used for seizing and disemboweling prey. The robust hind limb shows extensive fusion of bones in its proportionally short distal portion, with formation of a tibiotarsus and a tarsometatarsus. These unusual features suggest that Baldar was capable of delivering powerful strikes with its feet. And Seuss contends that these changes were likely due to the island effect as well. So just another peculiar example of a fossil species that was not found elsewhere, but was warped, was changed, and took on a special form due to its isolation on this island.
You got the gutting kick.
Yeah.
Well, now maybe I think you've changed my mind on my number one time travel destination. I think I want to go to Hattig.
Well, I would definitely visit Hattig if Hattig were a special exhibit at a Jurassic Park type scenario. But that brings me back to my past rants about Jurassic Park. Like, why do we keep coming back to the same and in many cases outdated dinosaur and prehistoric forms when we could be encountering these creatures?
Uh-huh.
Like, this should be the next Jurassic Park film, in my opinion, is, you know, don't bring back the T-Rex. Don't bring back the Velociraptors. Don't change their color just so you can sell a slightly different toy to the kids. You can still sell plenty of toys to the kids, but make it these. You know, make it pony-sized sauropods. Make it Hotsagopterex. I think Hotsagopterex would make a terrific CGI villain.
I think that there's a lot of potential here. I mean, people would want to have – they'd have reason for bringing back a pony-sized sauropod if they could have a petting zoo, kids could ride them. That's more plausible plot-wise.
All right. So there you have it. We're gonna leave it right there. Again, that really cool children's dinosaur book, Atlas of Dinosaur Adventures by Emily Hawkins and illustrated by Lucy Leatherhead. It's definitely in print, definitely worth picking up. And I think it's worth picking up even if you don't have any kids in your house or in your life. If you love dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures and or, geology and geography, mm-hmm. it's a great a tabletop book, if nothing else. But you can also spend lots of time reading through it with young ones and feeding their need for dinosaurs and pterosaurs, et cetera. Also, obviously, we surely have listeners who either reside or are from Romania or have visited Romania, and perhaps you've visited some of these areas. Some of the articles we were looking at mentioned that, you know, there are, you know, attempts to celebrate paleontology in Romania, mm-hmm. Various museums that have, you know, the efforts that have been put together. So we would love to read your field reports on Romanian paleontology. And ultimately, just, you know, the world that we are discussing in this episode, only, you know, millions of years later.
Absolutely. Also, send us your Baron Friends Nopcsa fanfic.
In the meantime, if you want more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. And if you want to support the show, the best thing you can do is to rate and review wherever you have the power to do so, but also make sure you have subscribed. And hey, we have another podcast titled Invention, and I think you should give that a shot. You should subscribe to that as well. And you might be thinking, oh, I don't know, Robert and Joe, I really like these trippier episodes, these weirder episodes that you put together. I don't know how trippy and weird technology is. Well, I just want to read you a quick quote from Terrence McKenna on technology to remind you otherwise. He says, we take in matter that has a low degree of organization. We put it through mental filters, and we extrude jewelry, gospels, space shuttles. This is what we do. We are like coral animals embedded in a technological reef of extruded psychic objects. And that's exactly what we talk about every week on Invention.
Couldn't have put it better, yeah.
So make sure you check it out. Make sure you have subscribed to Invention.
Subscribe to Invention. Anyway, huge thanks to our audio producers, Seth Nicholas Johnson and Maya Cole. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good it?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.